When your ideal customer's kids are begging every night to read your book, you've won. At Dinosaur House, we turn industry leaders into kids' book authors. We don't do it because it's a super fun thing to do, although it is. We do it because it's highly strategic. Imagine if every night your customers are being asked by their kids to read a book that your company made. Talk about brand affinity. You're helping your customers connect deeply with the most important thing in their lives, their kids, over something that they are passionate about that has to do with your industry. If you want to have a conversation with us about how your brand could become the author of a kid's book, just hit us up, dinosaurhouse.com. Hit the little button that says schedule a story design call. And we'll have a jam session together on just what your company's kids book could and should be.
What's up, everybody? It's Craig Dowden here. I'm passionate about bridging the gap between what science knows and what leaders do. I'm an executive coach, award-winning keynote speaker, and best-selling author of a couple of books, A Time to Lead, Mastering Yourself So You Can Master Your World, and Do Good to Lead Well, The Science and Practice of Positive Leadership. And I'm excited to be on The Purpose-Driven Entrepreneur.
What's up, Purpose-Driven Entrepreneurs? It's me, your host, Timmy Bauer, and my guest today is Craig Dowden. Craig, I just finished reading your second book, A Time to Lead. It was a wild experience. I blew through it. Just to kick things off, one of the first things that you talk about in your book is this thing called VUCAfication. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that right. What is VUCAfication?
Yeah, and it's a great question about it. And is that a word? And I said things are VUCAfied, so we're having some fun here with the core. It really came out of, it's a term that came out of the military. And what it was designed to do, to be an acronym to describe the world we're living in, and another way of saying, you know, it's crazy out there, like a lot going on. And so VUCA stands for volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. And so what's really key around that, and I love the acronym, and it kind of sets the stage for where we are and where we're going to go. As you mentioned, Timmy, it's going to get more VUCAfied as we move along. And so this really sets the stage when we think about ourselves leading our personal lives, leading in a professional organization. This is mission critical. And two key elements of that I want to highlight: the uncertainty and ambiguity. As human beings, if you want to ramp up your stress level, maximize uncertainty and ambiguity, and is really challenging for us. So that's also incredibly important.
Yeah. Who is this book written for, A Time to Lead? Like, who's the person that you have in mind when you were writing it?
Well, thank you for that question, because when we set out, to me, the title sounds like it's written for leaders, and inspiring leaders, shall we say, aspiring leaders. Fundamentally, at its core, we are all CEOs of our own lives. We play all of those roles. And so for me, and one of the most rewarding pieces of feedback that I had from readers is that people said, well, these are skills that are transferable to my personal life, to my personal relationships, to me figuring out how I can be my best self outside of work. So although the context within which the book is written is around leadership and leaders within organizations, it's truly these qualities, the seven leadership qualities that I cover in the book, are apply in any context, circumstance.
Yeah. You said early on in the book that the title sprang to your mind versus your last book. You had to think hard about your last book's title, but this one sprang to your mind. Why did it spring to your mind?
Well, it was, I wrote this during COVID. So COVID came upon us. And I have the privilege of coaching very senior executives, C-suite CEOs, and initiated several CEO mastermind forums. And an ongoing topic of conversation was, well, how are we going to get out of this? And then as we unpacked that question, it was really more about, how am I going to get out of this? And so the fundamental idea was great leadership starts with great self-leadership. And so that was the organizing principle. And then from there, a couple of key points was around the mastering. And that was a purposeful term because it's a lifelong journey and process. And so that was really critical in terms of the title. And yourself being two words, important because, well, now we want to step outside of ourselves, take more of an independent lens in terms of what are the steps that we need to take. And the core title, A Time to Lead, has there ever been a more important time to lead than right now, both personally and professionally?
A lot of people probably would know you maybe better from your other book, Do Good to Lead Well, The Science and Practice of Positive Leadership. What are the differences between the content and the reason for writing that book versus this one?
Well, it's funny when I, you know, talk to people that I know, clients, friends, family, it's almost like in some ways wrote them in the reverse, because Do Good to Lead Well, the six pillars of positive leadership that I outline, I talk about them almost in terms of Venn diagrams and that they overlap. And the first book is almost, you know, the core ideas around, well, how do we lead others? What are the key things that we want to do there? This book is really around self-leadership. So what are those core qualities that I can look at within myself and engage in the journey of mastering those skills, like mastering our mindset, our emotions, our resiliency, and our strengths? And so they are overlapping and complementary, yet the focus, if you will, this one is really about self. Do Good to Lead Well is how do we lead others?
Yeah. Who is Alan Mulally? And I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his name right either. And how did you join up with him, and what was the reason for featuring him so heavily in the book?
Well, great job. Kudos. Yes, Alan Mulally, bang on there. And he is the legendary former CEO of Ford Motor Company, as well as Boeing Commercial Airplanes. He's one of the most highly celebrated, respected CEOs of all time. He was Time Magazine's, he was number three person of the year. He engineered a remarkable turnaround at Ford. So when he took over, to give a sense of his impact, their stock price was $1.01. And when he left, it was $18.26, I believe. So what an extraordinary turnaround during his time. And Ford, if people recall, during the recession, they were the only major automotive company that did not receive a bailout during that time. So he just, what he was able to accomplish was extraordinary. And he reached out, we were able to connect while I was writing the book. It actually happened late in the stages. The manuscript was basically ready to go. And one of my goals was that I wanted to have CEO masterclasses. And in the first book, one of the key lessons learned was people would say, oh, okay, well, this all sounds great. Does this apply in my company, right? I am this size, or I'm global, or I'm publicly traded. And so what I wanted to do was highlight different CEOs and other senior execs that I coach and share, hey, these qualities apply. Well, when Alan reached out, talked to me about my first book, and then I shared with him that I was writing the second, shared the vision for that, having CEO masterclasses, and I asked Alan, would you consider teaching those masterclasses, because you've led two of the most globally recognized and most complex organizations in the world. And so thankfully, as we went back and forth in our conversation and sharing the manuscript, he agreed. And so the reason I was so excited to have him involved, not just because of the extraordinary career that he's had, is that he's lived these qualities within his working together management system principles and practices. And so if he has led their integration in two massive multinational companies, well, then if someone's, well, I'm not sure if they apply here, it's a pretty compelling argument, counter argument.
Yeah. What is the working together management system?
So what it does is outline a series of principles and practices so that people can work together most effectively at our best. And what I love about his philosophy is that the foundational idea, people first, love them up. Yeah. And so every single person is valued. Every single person has the potential to contribute. And it's our responsibility, individual and collective, to create the conditions under which people can contribute to the best of their abilities. And so that's really the rallying cry. And if we're not prepared, and what I love about Alan is that relentless adherence to that system. So even Timmy, if you're an exceptional performer, but you don't want to respect people, or if you're like, hey, I just want to drive, like, who cares about people? We're just here to feed the bottom line, and my division is going to be ahead. Alan's response would be, that's wonderful, Timmy. That's, you know, appreciate that. And I'm sure there are other organizations out there that would love to have you. And how can I help you get there? So there's no judgment. There isn't animosity, conflict. It's just, these are the core principles and practices that we live by. They represent the core of who we are.
Yeah. When you said the first one, people first, love them up, it reminds me of a friend of mine who, one of his core values at his business is love people well. And what he's found over the years is that he's really had to work really hard to clarify what he means when he says love people well, because people that have taken that core value the wrong way, it's helped create a culture of entitlement in his organization. So how do you combat, when you have a love people first kind of way of looking at work, how do you combat fostering a culture of entitlement?
Well, and it's a fantastic question. What's key is, and back to the principles and practices, is being clear on our expectations. And so loving people first, and love people first, love them up. Well, there are also, that's part of it. And that's the foundation of our culture. Then we have a collective set of goals and objectives that we're pursuing, and a set of expectations to get there, and accountability to ensure that we do that. So that informs our behaviors. And yet at the same time, nothing supersedes what's happening. And so I love where you talk about that culture of entitlement. Well, if we're pursuing that at the expense of all else, well, now there can be that risk. What's beautiful about the Working Together management system, it lays out all of the different components of that equation so that people are fully aware. And here's what's also invaluable, is that there's a one plan that everybody's aware of. Everyone understands what their objectives are, what their responsibilities are, how we hold each other to account. So again, that entitlement piece, we're all in this together. No one is more or less important than the other person. We each have a role to play.
So getting into the different focuses of self-leadership that you talk about, the first one that you go into is mindset. Just to frame the conversation, how do you define a fixed mindset versus a growth mindset?
Well, this comes from the tremendous and groundbreaking work of Carol Dweck, probably one of the most widely respected psychologists of all time. And the research, which is really fascinating, started with children. And then it got applied within corporate context because the power of the ideas. And so a fixed mindset, when we're in a fixed mindset, basically it's that, well, I've hit the limits of my potential. Like, I can't grow anymore. I am at the apex of who I am. And it doesn't matter how much effort I put in. It doesn't matter how many different things that I try. I've arrived. Full stop. When we're in growth mindset, this is much different. Now, my philosophy is, it's really around effort. How am I contributing? How much focus and enthusiasm am I engaging in my tasks? To me, what I'm most interested in is exploring different pathways to get the outcome that I want. So when I'm in growth mode, so a great example, a challenge. So if I present a challenge to you, Timmy, when you're in fixed mindset, it's like, I don't want to try that, because if I fail, I'm never going to be able to do that because I can't grow. And then people are going to think poorly of me. When I'm in growth mindset, I look at it and go, wow, this is an awesome chance for me to test the limits of my potential today. And through that experience, regardless of where I end up, I'm going to learn how I can better tackle those challenges in the future. So as you can appreciate, in the same situation, whether I'm in a growth mindset or a fixed mindset has profound implications on the things that I say, and equally, if not more importantly, the choices that I make.
Yeah. One of the things that you said in the book that I thought was interesting, you said people with a fixed mindset, their primary goal is to appear smart. I thought that was interesting, but what do you mean by that?
Yeah. And again, if my belief system is that I've grown to the limit of my potential, like I have this level of intelligence. Now I have to look smart. I can't look like I don't know something, because once again, what does that mean? I can never fix that. It's now and forever. So my goal is to make sure that people think that I'm smart, because now, okay, that reflects really well on me, and there's confidence in me, and I can continue to succeed. And so I, as another example, if I make mistakes, well, what am I going to do? I'm going to conceal them, hide them, externalize them, blame someone else for it. Well, what does that do? Prevent an opportunity for me to learn. Where I'm in growth mindset, I'm going to come to you and say, hey, Timmy, I'm dealing with this issue. What have you done? Or I'm really struggling here. What advice do you have for me? And once again, same situation, different mindset has a profoundly different impact on how successful we'll be.
What would you say is a common misconception that people have about growth mindset and fixed mindset, even from, say, people that have heard the concepts or think that they understand the concepts?
A very astute question. And one of the most common is, especially when we tend to default in the growth mindset, is that, well, I'm always in growth mindset. What's funny about that is that that in and of itself is a fixed mindset statement, because it cannot change. And what's important to recognize is that there's a continuum. We can fluctuate between being in a growth mindset and a fixed mindset. It's theoretically possible during our discussion today, each of us can move from growth to fixed. What's vital for us in our development is to recognize the triggers that can put us more in growth mode versus fixed mode.
Yeah, it's so funny because, like, I think I wrestle with imposter syndrome constantly. So if wanting to appear smart is a trigger to tell me that I am in fixed mindset, now I'm going to be constantly self-conscious of this. I'm going to be like, man, I want to appear smart right now. I must be in fixed mindset.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. And I think, and then what's really interesting, so, you know, in coaching executives who are going in for interviews as an example. So great. Great, great topic, right? And then they're going in and then boy, like, do I belong? And am I right for the role? And so a couple of really key things to reflect on, right? Building on your great example, which is, okay, so I've been invited and I belong. So they wouldn't invite me in here if this wasn't, if I didn't have a contribution to make. And then on top of that, stepping back and saying, okay, this is a beautiful opportunity for me to learn, a wonderful chance for me to get to know other people, to get to know about a different role, be it in my organization or elsewhere. What knowledge can I gain through this experience? Once again, just by flipping the script on our mindset changes how we show up in these situations.
Yeah, 100%. You, so in addition to spending a lot of time in the book on mindset, you talk a lot about emotions. Well, what's the difference between a focus on a mindset versus a focus on emotions?
Well, to me, and perhaps it'll oversimplify, I would say it's a left brain, right brain. So that mindset is the thinking pattern, how we're analyzing and creating perspective in our world. The emotional side of it is that, okay, so how do we react outside of our intellect as emotional creatures? And I think both of those in tandem are incredibly powerful because we need both. I've had the distinct pleasure of interviewing numerous CEOs on my own podcast and in my coaching work and in writing this book. And several of them, one of the best ways I've heard it described is that to be successful as a leader and a CEO is we must lead with our hearts and our minds. So mindset being mind, heart, the emotional side of it. And so being aware of our emotions and mastering our emotions is vital because as human beings, that's what provides the motivational fuel for us when we're at work and when we're at home.
What's different about the way that leaders manage their emotions versus, say, the average person?
Well, I think what's really interesting is for a very long time, emotions were almost seen as they had no place at work. Can't be emotional, can't be too emotional, like leave your emotions at the door. And what's fascinating is if you think about the concept of engagement, what's engagement if it's not emotional? That's a core part of connection. And so I think for a very long time, there was this profound misperception that emotions have no place, must be cold, calculated, all about analysis. And this is really disconnected from the human experience. It's not reflective of reality. And fortunately, I think that's starting to shift. And we're starting to see more of a focus on well-being, mental health. And that also comes with some challenging conversation as well. As we start to build those muscles and skills, I would say that's one big shift in terms of our organizational landscape is around how our view of emotions and the role that they play in organizations have changed.
I think part of the reason that people view work as not like a, maybe it's that people view successful people at work as not super emotional people, I think is because non-reactivity is one of the characteristics of a successful person. Or at least that's been the case for me. I've noticed that the most successful people know how to be non-reactive, and reactivity is emotional.
And I think that's a great point. And to build on that, what I would say is that what people are highly skilled and what they're able to do is pick up on the cue. So going back to leading with our hearts and our minds, they understand in what situation and with which individuals you need to lean more in which direction or the other. Right. And I think that is what's critical. And you touched on that, the reactivity, because if I get overwhelmed, flustered, and then I lash out, I act out. Well, OK, that's likely going to not go well for me and the people around me. So having that balanced perspective and recognize. So rather than saying emotions are appropriate or inappropriate, what they're able to do is calibrate that expression. And I've coached and worked with CEOs who, during the pandemic and as we continue to move through where we are today, expressed vulnerability that they had not before and started to let people in on some of their internal struggles. And, hey, you know, I've got concerns too, and are infusing more of that emotion into their conversations. And that has had the biggest impact of people reaching out and going, thank you for doing that. And, you know, and I'm feeling the same way. And it really made me appreciate you being so open and honest and authentic with us.
Yeah. When I think about it, it's like, there is clearly like as an owner of a business, I definitely value reactivity in certain contexts. Like, you know, when the account manager is reacting quickly to a problem, I'm like, that's great. Cause I'm very non-reactive. So like problems arise and I'm like, I'm going to stay focused. I'll get to that thing, but that's not necessarily the skill set that you want in an account manager. So there's like a balance for reactivity versus non-reactivity.
Well, and this is a great, and I love that we're parsing this down because this is important, right? There's reactivity through action and reactivity through emotion. And then having some more fun with this, right? How those two interact, because if I'm reacting quickly to a challenge in front of me, that's fantastic. If I'm reacting quickly and it comes with very strong negative emotion, aggression, frustration, fear, well, now that's going to undermine the potential benefits of being reactive. So driving action through fear, lots of evidence that shows us when we're in a fear-based mindset, we do not make high quality decisions. We might sustain a short-term burst of energy. Long-term, it's not going to go well. So that's where, again, recognizing those pieces and how to be able to craft. So, you know, the classic John Wooden quote about be fast, but don't rush. I may paraphrase that. It's recognizing, hey, we'll be quick. Let's not over index on that.
Yeah. And these are very, very hard things to balance. Are there, when you find that you're coaching executives, do they struggle with this balance? And like, how does that typically show up in your coaching with them?
Well, for sure. It's, and this is the pace of life these days, the things, the change. I mean, ChatGPT and all kinds of other stuff coming through. It's, if you and I talked 6 months ago and said, well, what would the world look like now?
I would not have guessed ChatGPT.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. 3 years ago, before the pandemic, like, hey, what do you think we'll be doing if we chatted now, right? 3 years from now, what would that look like? We could have never anticipated this.
Yeah.
And in a world that almost we feel demands immediacy, right? Like through Twitter and text and all of that, just an onslaught of information. What's happening is that urgency is everywhere. And we feel like everything is urgent and immediate. And the other challenge of that, just quickly make a sidebar observation, is just because we're urgently taking care of things doesn't mean we're particularly effective.
Yeah.
And we're actually making meaningful progress. We might be doing a whole bunch of stuff and not really accomplishing much. And I think the trick is just to slow down momentarily. So an executive that I'm coaching and just had a conversation this morning where one of the challenges is they get excited and then interrupt, right? Oh, well, Timmy, I got to say this. And then what we talked about was saying, okay, being aware of the signals. Like, so in their body, it was, I can feel I'm leaning in, I'm getting amped up. And then so the thought was, 5 second pause, one. So when I get there, just taking 5 seconds, that's it. And then another strategy, I'm going to ask another question. I'm not allowed to talk. I can't say something to Timmy, give my feedback on his idea until I've asked at least one follow-up question. Very challenging because we're so used to being reactive. Yet the power in that, to your point about mastering that and showing up in the fullness of ourselves, invaluable. Because again, so few people are doing it.
There is a thing that you talked about in your book that I have to ask you about, and it's scheduling worry time. What is scheduling worry time? What's the benefit of it?
Yeah, it was one of my favorite. I'm a big science fan. I just love research because there's so much valuable nuggets. And so scheduling worry time, this was just fantastic. And they've done multiple studies on this. There were chronic worriers. And so one of the challenges is that, so you and I, we're doing email or what have, or we're involved in a project, and then something pops into my mind, I start to worry about it. And then this can derail us in terms of our focus or our productivity. So what they did was say, hey, whenever a worry creeps into your brain, so let's say it comes in now, what you do is you schedule some time. So let's say it's 7 o'clock tonight. So just have a worry journal, write it down. This is what I'm going to worry about at 7 p.m. When 7 p.m. shows up, worry about it. Think about it then. And what they found was this had a significant impact on people's emotional well-being, their level of resilience, their level of productivity and effectiveness, because, hey, okay, I've written this down, I've captured it, I'm gonna worry about it later, so now I can return my focus. Because that loss of focus, there's great research from Microsoft that when you're engaged in knowledge-based work, it can take anywhere from 15 to 27 minutes on average to return to the same level of focus when we're distracted. So by being able to write it down and then return, I've really minimized the distraction, And now both things have been accomplished. I've set aside the time and I can re-engage in the task. Now, what magically happens at 7 o'clock is in some cases I look at the item and I'm going, oh, that's not a big deal now. Or it's taken care of itself. And I love both of those realizations, because how many of us has that happened? And then, hey, and at seven, if I still need to worry about it, fantastic. Now I can take the steps that I need to do. And a couple of other key insights from this research is that they said, as much as possible, schedule it at the same time and in the same place. So it's almost, once again, and from a mindset, I'm transitioning now into my worry time. Another companion piece of research, and that's the final point that I'll make, because I think it's just so remarkable. When they asked people to track their worries in a separate study, what they found was the vast majority of cases, what we worry about does not come true.
Yeah.
And so it's like 90%. And it's remarkable because a couple of things. Number one, the things we worry about don't come to pass. And what's also problematic is you get the double impact, because you're worrying about something. So the anticipation of the worry coming true, so you're dealing with it now, and then you still have to deal with the impact when it happens. So I just love those ideas about how to more effectively manage our worries.
Yeah, I think also stress, it has a tendency to like live, this might sound a little woo-woo, but this is just my own experience. It lives in our bodies. It's like background radiation. So if we are passively stressed about something, it is going to affect us all throughout the day. So I like the idea of like, okay, I'll jot it down, I'll worry about it at worry time. It also reminds me of two practices that I do in my life. I'm curious if you've heard of practical pessimism. It's where you write what you're worried about, and then you write basically like a series of if-then statements around that thing coming true. Yes. And it has whenever I've done it, it has greatly reduced the amount of worry that I have. And then the other thing that I do, obviously, is I'm a Christian, so I pray. So I'll go for walks around the lake and I'll pray about the things that I'm worried about.
Absolutely. And I think what's really interesting is in both of those examples, right? And you talked about this earlier on in another area, which is, so we're taking a more mindful, a more intentional, a more balanced approach to things, and centering ourselves within that. And I do appreciate how you frame stress, because the way I describe it, I'll say stress is our mind, our body, our heart's way of letting us know we're in misalignment. It's a early warning signal. And so now, rather than judging it, again, it's like, oh, well, I want to avoid it or minimize it. No, this is invaluable data for us. So now, just like medicine, early intervention is key. So acknowledging the stress, okay, it's there for a reason. I accept it because it's related to something I care about. So what am I going to do with that? How am I going to address it? Again, I'll put it in my worry journal for later on. That is, stress is natural and part of life. And also, and this is what's fascinating from the stress research as well, like stress provides us activation energy to resolve what's going on. So now we have a choice about how to use it.
It was very interesting to hear how positively you talk about stress in the book, because I think, and you even say this in the book, like when most people think about stress, they think about it's a bad thing. And I think I'm curious to hear your challenge to this, because it's like, in a sense, they are right. Stress is linked to a ton of health problems.
Yes. And so there's a great, there's been fabulous work done. And Kelly McGonigal, one of the top health psychologists, she has a wonderful TED talk and a terrific book called The Upside of Stress. She talks about this research, and it was written up in the Wall Street Journal as well and other top tier publications. So they did this study where they had over 30,000 people, and they investigated the very point that you just raised, and the link between stress and risk of early mortality based on probability. And okay, great. So what they did find was, yes, stress and early mortality, that there's a relationship there. Then they went one layer down and they said, all right, well, what about the stress mindset, the beliefs that we have about stress? And what they found was that relationship only existed for people whose belief was that stress is harmful to them. Individuals who have the belief that stress is natural, that stress can be beneficial, that stress is a part of life, there was zero correlation. And to me, I agree, it's fascinating. And what I found was especially revealing was that people who reported having higher levels of stressful events in their lives actually had a lower risk of early mortality than those where they had lower stress events, yet their beliefs were that stress would harm them. And so recognizing that how our beliefs manifest and how they can affect not just our emotional well-being, our physical well-being is really critical. And so one of the things that in my conversations, coaching conversations and elsewhere, I'll ask audiences and say, think about your mindset around, what's your stress mindset? What are your beliefs around stress? And one more, how might those beliefs affect the choices that you're making? So as a quick example, if I believe stress is harmful to me, and then I start to feel stress, well, what's a likely response? I may minimize or ignore it. I'm going to procrastinate. I might engage in, you know, drinking or other kinds of behavior, maladaptive coping, because I don't want to deal with it. I don't want to acknowledge it. Well, it's going to grow and grow and grow. And now it can be even more harmful. So recognizing the impact that my mindset has on the choices that I'm going to make, incredibly important.
That's so good. Craig, there's so much more that we could talk about your book. I encourage people to read it. It's called A Time to Lead. You also talk about strengths versus weaknesses and when to focus on which ones. You talk about resilience, how to give and receive feedback, difficult conversations and authentic leadership. But one question I want to ask you, Craig, because this is sort of the reason I started this podcast. I started this show because I wanted to ask purpose-driven entrepreneurs about the purpose behind what they're doing. I wanted to ask them how they want to be remembered when they die, or what is the purpose behind their life's work? So when you think about a big question like, what's the legacy I'm trying to leave? What is it that I really want to accomplish? How do I want to be remembered? What jumps out to you as most important?
Yeah, no, and I very much appreciate this question. And it's what gets me out of bed in the morning. I just love of engaging in the mystery of unlocking human potential. We all have strengths that we bring into the world. We all have core passions and core values. And what I love to do is engage, like today, in a conversation with you and wrestle with that journey and learn through that journey. And when people trust me as a conversational co-pilot, if you will, in their own experiences and figuring that out, that means the world to me. And so I love that. And I love exploring different ways of looking at situations. So one of the best pieces of feedback that I love to hear from someone is when I ask a question, they say, wow, I hadn't thought about it in that way. Because what that suggests to me is there's an opportunity for growth there, which is why I'm so passionate about coaching and psychology, because it's really about being a guide and opening up a safe space to have conversations that mean the most to us. So that's my why. That's what I love. And that's where the backdrop of the research for me is so important, so that to inform those conversations, I lead with what the science says. What do the top thought leaders share with us?
And why is unlocking the human potential, or conversations around unlocking human potential, so important to you that it's one of the things that you want to hang your life on?
Well, I love the idea, and will raise my own hand as a you know, having a PhD in psychology, a specialization in business, the whole concept of flow. Like, the vast majority of people on this planet want to contribute in to the best of their ability to pursue bigger than self goals. And to do that, we have to bring the best version of ourselves, so we can also support other people and bring in the best version of themselves. And so there's just so much tremendous meaning behind that lifelong task. And for many of us, for most of us, for all of us, even staying clearly connected to that, especially with the pace of life and all the stuff that's going on, I would argue nothing is more important. Yes, it's incredibly challenging. Yeah. So then to be able to do that and take that moment of pause and then really connect back to who we are and what our core values are and what we value, to me, that's a great day.
Awesome. Craig, this has been a really fun conversation. I have two for fun questions that I want to ask you before I end it. So the first one is this. I'm a kids book author, and I believe part of leaving a legacy means reaching kids. What's a topic or idea you would make a kids book about if you could?
I love that question. I think it's fantastic. And to me, it's about writing a book around the importance of embracing the spirit of curiosity for your whole life. Kids are just innately curious. They ask, as adults, people laugh at the questions they ask, yet they're extraordinarily insightful. And I feel that as, you know, as we age and get older, what do we lose? That playfulness, that curiosity, that leading with questions. And so I would love my children's book would be about instilling that message that you've got life figured out now. This is the key to being successful. Don't lose that. As you grow older, keep that spirit of curiosity, because that will continue to serve you well.
What do you think the impact of that kid's book being widely read would be? Like, why do you think that's so important?
Because where the pace of change now is moving so incredibly fast. How do we keep up with that? It's through curiosity. Ideas that we talk about today, as much as I value our discussion and what we've covered, 2 weeks from now, we joked about ChatGPT. Like maybe there's a whole new thing that's happening. I mentioned before, I have this profound privilege to speak with extraordinary thought leaders. Ed Hess, he's written 16 books, multiple bestsellers. His latest book is called Own Your Work Journey. And I love this quote when he and I were speaking recently. He said, Craig, the people who are going to be most successful, both now and in the future, it's going to be based on the speed with which we learn, unlearn, and relearn. What's at the heart of that? Curiosity. When I lose curiosity of self, when I lose curiosity of others, how can I have a positive relationship with myself? How do I have positive relationships with other people? And there's so much happening. This leading with curiosity is everything.
Yeah.
And
that's
we
great.
Miss so much when we don't embrace our lives, either personally or professionally, with that spirit.
My last for fun question for you, Craig, is what is something that you currently suck at that a year from now you want to be great at?
Well, yeah, what do I say? Being organized. Okay. I think I'm so excited by ideas. And I keep that on my radar around, all right, so which are the ideas to pursue? I'm in a constant lifelong journey of creating more effective structures to be able to assign and prioritize the ideas that I pursue, because there's just so many things that I love to do. And I would also add to that, because despite the fact I'm a coach, I've been coaching for 20 years, asking questions, I want to be better at that next year.
Yeah.
I want to be better at listening next year. Like I want to be better at the power of the pause next year, creating more space for people to talk, not filling in the gaps. Those to me are the most precious and valuable skills. And the impact that they've had on me has been extraordinary. So I'm back to growth mindset. I want to keep pushing and going and be twice as skilled next year as I am today.
Same. That's actually one of the things that I've noticed I've gotten better at through this podcast, is because when I first started, I was a chronic interrupter. I would steer the conversation, drive the conversation, and I was the only one speaking a lot of times in the conversation. So the power of the pause, that resonates with me. And just like learning to ask good questions is such a skill. One day, like if I write a book for adults, I ask my wife, you know, what do you think, based on you knowing me, what do you think is a book that I should write if I was going to write a book for adults? And she said something that to me felt like it came out of left field, but she was like, you should write a book called Solving Problems with Questions, because you're so good at encountering a problem and coming up with a set of questions that will lead to the solution to that problem. I was like, dang, okay. So I've just had this on my mind for a while now, like one day I'm going to write a book called Solving Problems with Questions.
Well, and I love, and this is such a passion topic for me as well, because, and here's what's also interesting to bridge these ideas together, is that sometimes we ask this incredibly powerful question, and then the other person is sitting with that. And in fact, it's a really impactful question. And then we ask a follow-up because we're so uncomfortable with the silence, or we feel like they're not sure about our question, and then we make it more closed-ended. We've lost the power of that initial question. And so asking the question and then just and letting it take that space.
Agreed.
And not rushing, even if it's 15, 20, 30, a minute and a half. It's awesome when we let go of that and just allow it to take the space. And I think that is, again, just such, and especially in a world where it seems like people can't stop talking, creating some silence is incredibly restorative and connecting. And it stands out because it's something that, again, we can feel is rare.
A minute and a half is a painful amount of silence. That's like best friend level silence. There's no time longer than a minute and a half when it comes to silence.
Absolutely. And it's funny you should say that, because I had a friend of mine that, you know, that was, it was a wonderful masterclass. It elevated, it escalated my learning, because that was silence. It was a transformative moment where silence is okay. And in fact, long periods of silence, to your point, it's best friend level interaction. And so if we think about that, imagine what the impact that is in all of our relationships, where we feel safe enough to have that there, and we're both kind of just sitting with it.
Yeah. Craig, this has been a wonderful conversation. Where would you like listeners to connect with you?
You can go to my website, craigdowden.com. I'm also on LinkedIn, and please let me know that you came from the Purpose-Driven Entrepreneur, because I'd love to connect with you. So I would happy to connect. And if you have any questions about any of the authors, books, articles that I've referenced today, I just love what I do. I love being a part of conversations like this. And thank you, Timmy, for your enthusiasm in this platform. I've thoroughly enjoyed myself, and this has been a lot of fun as well. So
awesome. Same.